Black lives matter. The words are simple, but to put them into practice is a necessary and radical act. NPR correspondent and New York Times bestselling author Kwame Alexander's new book, Light for the World to See, is a powerful and provocative collection of poems that cut to the heart of the entrenched racism and oppression in America and eloquently explores ongoing events. A book in the tradition of James Baldwin's A Report from Occupied Territory, Light for the World to See is a lyrical response to the struggles of Black lives in our world, to America's crisis of conscience, to the centuries of loss, endless resilience, and unstoppable hope. Alexander is the best-selling author of 32 books, including the Newbery Medal-winning middle-grade novel The Crossover and the 2020 Caldecott Medal-winning picture book The Undefeated. It is a great pleasure to welcome Kwame Alexander to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on our program. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. Thank you for having me for this discussion.
Very nice to have you on the program. My understanding from reading the preface of the book is that this basically started a journey for you long ago, going back to late 1970s, where you yourself were thrust into activism and trying to understand why you initially had difficulties in saying the words that ultimately meant Black Lives Matter. So give us a sense of what the journey then that took place to where we are now, that you wanted to explore this in poems.
Sure. I mean, I was 10 years old, and I was living in Brooklyn, New York with my family. My father was the headmaster of our school, which was, you know, a trauma in and of itself. But I went to a school that was called an independent Black institution. So it was all Black kids. And the goal was to raise, nurture, develop, educate Black children who had a high level of self-esteem and who could exist in this world and not be destroyed by racism or oppression and be uplifted by their identity. So one particular day we were told we weren't going to school. We were going to march over the Brooklyn Bridge to protest the police killing of a Black man in Crown Heights. And certainly I felt that was necessary, and it was a necessary thing to do to protest that. And I wanted to speak up for that. And I talked amongst my friends about that tragedy. We talked about it at my dinner table. But I decided I wasn't going to march over the bridge because I was afraid. I just knew that there were certainly going to be police officers on the other side of the bridge awaiting us, and who knows what my fate would be then. And secondly, I thought, well, they'll probably open up the Brooklyn Bridge and we'll all fall in and die. This is what my 10-year-old mind thought. Of course, the Brooklyn Bridge can't be opened. But I was dragged to this march, you know, about 1,000 people. It was led by the Reverend Herbert Daughtry. And we're marching over the bridge. I'm crying. I'm afraid for my life. I mean, and we get to the other side, and there are the police officers, and they're on horses. And the policemen they're in riot gear, and there are dogs barking, and it's just the worst kind of scenario for my young mind. I think this is the end. And then, you know, Reverend Daughtry started singing and other people started singing, "We're fired up. We can't take no more. We're fired up. We can't take no more." And my dad started singing and I started singing. And I got to tell you, I think the tears just sort of, they froze. They stopped. And the fear certainly was there, but I just faced it. And the words, the song, the visual melody, that helped me. And that was sort of, I couldn't articulate it then, but that was the beginning of my journey to sort of, you know, understanding what Toni Morrison meant when she said, "This is precisely the time when artists go to work. There's no time for despair, no place for self-pity, no need for silence, no room for fear. We speak, we write, because that's how civilizations heal." And that was the beginning of me sort of lifting my voice and using words to as an activist.
And in lifting your voice and turning to art, in your case, you went to poetry. You write in the preface, "In this moment, as we grapple with the fear, the uncertainty, the awakening, I turn to poetry, a small but powerful emotional geography that has the ability to reach inside of us, map our humanity, anchor us on solid ground, heal, and lift our souls to the heights of joy." You talk about the three poems that are included in this collection as being your bombs. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think of Negro spirituals, which are timeless in their comfort and in their guidance. I mean, they have roots in praise houses and ring shouts and other informal gatherings of enslaved Africans who just needed to express their sorrows, but also their hopes. I think of Wade in the Water, "Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen," "Steal Away to Jesus." That's what these poems in Light for the World to See are for me. They were these comfort psalms, these soothing balms for my soul. And so that was the way that I needed to sort of chart my way to this freedom, because after the killing of George Floyd, after the killing of Breonna Taylor, after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, this weight of being Black was a heavy burden to carry. And that is not to mean that I didn't like being Black or I was not proud of my Blackness. It just meant that the outside world was weighing down heavy on my Blackness, on our Blackness. And so I needed to have some way to combat that. And for me, the poems were the thing that did that. I think, you know, I tell young people all the time when I travel to schools that poetry, because it's so concise, because it's so rhythmic, because it's so short, because it's so figurative, it can sort of capture these really heavy, weighty things and distill them down into something that's ultimately digestible. I think the power of poetry is that it can engage with us. It can inform us. It can uplift us. And that's what I needed to have happen to me. And that's what I hoped the poems in this book would do for folks who read it.
The name of the book is Light for the World to See by Kwame Alexander. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. So as you described, there are basically three moments that you snapshot here, one being right after the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers, the other being after Colin Kaepernick kneeled during the playing of the national anthem, and then finally, which is going back to 2008, your second daughter is born, and Barack Obama has just become the 44th president of the United States. Obviously, there are many key moments I assume that you could have chosen. Are these the three that you chose for the collection, or were these really the three moments that spoke to you in turning to art, as you say, to explore and try to figure it out?
Yeah. I looked at these poems as, you know, doing two things. And this is how I chose the poems. One was I needed to remind white people that in order to understand how we make things better, how we create this better future for ourselves and our children, we have to understand what we did wrong in the past. And so I needed to sort of paint this picture of tragedy. And I feel like in order for people to change the way they act, to change the way they behave, they have to first change the way they think. And in order for that to happen, you have to change the way you feel. So I needed to write this piece that was going to get at the feeling that this tragedy, that this injustice brings about. So that was the first thing. And so that's where that first poem comes from. It's a demand to recognize what has gone wrong, what has happened that has led us to this critical boiling point that we're at in America. And then you move from there to, you know, to that last poem. And And so the goal here was to remind Black people that, yes, there was tragedy, but we survived it. We're still here. So I wanted to write a book that showcased the tragedy and coming from the tragedy to the triumph. I wanted to show the woes and the wonder. I knew that starting in that place with the first poem, American Bullet Points, was going to be dark, was going to be sorrowful and despondent and horrible and horrid and all these sort of, you know, negative, you know, feelings that we get from this sort of brutality. But I didn't want to leave you there. You know, Joe, I traffic in hope. I am an ultimate optimist. I am a say yes person. And so if I'm going to write a book that's going to make you feel uncomfortable, by the end of the book, I need to make you feel like you have a grasp on how to get comfortable. And that comes from hope.
When you write, as you say, the first poem, I'm curious about a couple of things about it. One is that as it mentions in the book, you wrote it, you're talking to us from England right now. You wrote the book while in London, England. Or you wrote the first poem. What was it like to watch that event take place in the United States of America and during a pandemic and being away from the homeland and viewing that from afar and yet feeling it so viscerally?
Wow. So that's a great question, Joe. I think there were so many things going on through my head. Number one, you know, during the lockdown due to COVID in London, as in America, so many places were closed. There, you know, it was a new kind of living. You could not go into a restaurant because restaurants were closed. Schools were closed. So the only thing I was able to do really was write and walk. London is a walking city. Mm. So I could walk Hyde Park. I could walk Regent's Park. I could spend hours walking. And it occurred to me that had I been back in my hometown in Virginia, or had I been in Evanston, Illinois, where I was on tour with going to schools, and a friend of mine, Randy Preston, was walking and he got stopped by police. He was just out for a morning stroll. Had I been in America, I would probably have had some serious, not probably, I would have had serious anxiety, fear, fright, and would not have been able to walk. I would not have been able to walk. And so that occurred to me that I had this sort of freedom to move about through London and not feel any anxiety. And that reminded me of another thing. You know, I saw why Baldwin and Richard Wright and Josephine Baker and Chester Himes and all these Black artists, and they moved to Europe. I have never felt more American in England. I've never felt that American that I feel in England than when I lived in America. Mm. And I find that I don't walk around with that sort of chip on my shoulder. So that's it. That was sort of an interesting dichotomy. The second thing I felt is, you know, there were quite a few Black Lives Matter protests in England and as it was around the world. So it seemed as though the world was sort of, you know, throwing their arms up and screaming, we're fired up, we can't take no more. So I felt that energy, that camaraderie in England too. And I guess the third thing is, I am still an American. And so I have nephews who live in New York City. You know, I have friends with sons who live in Los Angeles and Charleston, South Carolina. I know what it is like to be a Black boy and a Black man growing up and living in America. And so that, you know, that poem that I wrote in London comes out of all of that, wanting to, again, to remind us of what is happening and to demand that we stop.
Kwame Alexander is our guest. The new book is Light for the World to See, 1,000 Words on Race and Hope. As I mentioned, there are three poems in the book. They are beautifully presented in this volume. I am hoping, sir, that you can share the first poem with us. We have talked about it in great detail. I'm hoping you can share it with us.
We can't see our home. We can't breathe the air. We can't break the chains. We can't run away. We can't speak our names. We can't keep our tongue. We can't learn to read. We can't sing a song. We can't be in love. We can't be a group. We can't shield our girls. We can't save our sons. We can't hold our own. We can't bend a knee. We can't take a stand. We can't save ourselves. We can't hold a gun. We can't stop that whip. We can't wear the skin. We can't hang ourselves. We can't run. We can't stay. We can't fight. We can't last. We can't vote. We can't voice. We can't whistle. We can't breathe. We can't breathe. We can't cross a bridge. We can't ride a bus. We can't be in church. We can't have a dream. We can't wear our skin. We can't wear a hood. We can't play our songs. We can't be ourselves. We can't be at home. We can't be alone. We can't be unarmed. We can't shoot ourselves. We can't hold a gun. We can't hold a toy. We can't hold a phone. We can't do a thing. We can't drive a car. We can't walk the street. We can't ride a bike. We can't run away. We can't be a boy. We can't be a man. We can't be afraid. We can't break these chains. We can't walk. We can't run. We can't breathe. We can't live. We can't breathe. We can't live, but we will not die.
American Bullet Points, Kwame Alexander, reading from the new book, Light for the World to See. That is absolutely beautiful. And, you know, I've read it three times in the print, but to hear you, to you recite it is just stunning. Give me a sense of that idea of bullet points. It seems to me there's double meaning there, of course, right?
Oh, yeah, well, definitely. So a couple things. The first thing is when I wrote the first draft of the poem, the last line of the poem was, but we can die.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it's true. But then I started thinking of the Langston Hughes poem, where he talks about, you know, the fact that we're still here, that perhaps we weren't meant to survive this middle passage, this chattel slavery. We weren't meant to survive it, but we're still here. We survived it all. We survived, you know, Jim Crow, and we survived, you know, lynching, and we survived, you know, all of these just terrible, inhumane, you know, actions against us. And so it made me remember that, wait a minute, but we will not die. Sure, we can die. That's sort of a natural sort of way to end that piece. But the truth is, we're still here. And so, and that came to me from a friend who had read it, Kevin Merida. And so I changed that last line to, but we will not die. And the second thing, Joe, was that each of these things that I say, you know, in each bullet point, of course we can do it because we did do it. Mm-hmm. We broke the chains. We ran away. We sang our songs. We are in love. You know, so it was sort of that dichotomy,
right,
of what we've been told that we can't do, but we will somehow figure out, you know, in the midst of the brutal plantation treatment and not being able to gather and not being able to read and not being able to sing, and these things, you know, being punishable by death in some circumstances, that we still did it. And I find that to be triumphant.
Kwame Alexander is our guest. The name of the new book is Light for the World to See, 1,000 Words on Race and Hope. In my reading of all of these poems, there is an urgency. There is a burst. There is an anger that is waiting to come out. It's an eruption. I heard that in your voice a moment ago. Is that the way they're written as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be urgent. It's now, you know, it's always urgent, and I'm trying to channel sort of the dreams and the hopes and that's not something that we want to wait on. It's why I guess my father made me march over that bridge, because it's got to stop, and you've got to take a voice. You've got to take a stand. You've got to lift your voice. The wound has been here. It didn't just start this summer or this spring. It began when Africans were first kidnapped and unloaded from ships, you know, in the harbor in Charleston and you know, in Alexandria, Virginia. These episodes of police killings are yet another brutality of the relationship between blacks and whites that has existed for over 400 years. And so, you know, this book is, you know, you talked about the James Baldwin book, which was sort of, you know, an inspiration, or the James Baldwin essay, A Report from Occupied Territory. And, you know, one of the things he's doing is he's making a plea. He says exactly, I am writing a report, which is also a plea for the recognition of our common humanity. And that is not what I'm doing. I am inspired by that plea that he made in 1966 in the July issue of The Nation. But I am making a demand. I'm writing a reminder and making a demand that we do better, that we be better. And that requires a sense of urgency, because every time a black man dies, it is, you know, it's a mother who's losing a son. It's a father who's losing a son. It's perhaps a child who's losing a father. It's a human being who's being lost to humanity. And we can't afford that. It's just not right.
Do you said before you have this dogged optimism, and that seems hard. I think I'm a white guy. I find it hard to find optimism. I don't know where you find optimism.
I try to think about it like this, Joe. My great, great, great grandmother and grandfather, who grew up on a plantation in North Carolina, that they had to work from sunup to sundown for free, that they were forced to engage in labor under the umbrella of a whip and chains, that they were not allowed to learn how to read or write, that they were not given proper, healthy, if not any food to survive on, that they witnessed and saw friends and family members stolen away or whipped or lynched, that they experienced or saw women who were raped, and they still found a way to make sure that their 6 and 7 and 9 year old kids and 12 and 14 year old kids smiled and had some modicum of hope that things are gonna get better, that we're going to cross over the River Jordan one day, that we're gonna wade in the water, that they still maintain some sort of familial kinship and bond in the midst of all that. How can I not have hope? Because, you know, my struggles are nothing like theirs. And so if I can't get my act together today, I'm in trouble, and we're in trouble. And so I choose not to be in trouble. I choose to realize that if these folks could, you know, as a metaphor, if these folks could build pyramids, you know, then perhaps my dreams are just milestones.
Right. And it's when you put it that way, and when you look at the long history, then obviously, and you put it into that context, it makes sense. But it is wearying as when you mix it with everything else, especially over this past year, when you mix it with everything else, that is the issue of just that it wears you down.
Yeah, because we're human beings,
right?
And that's natural. It's gonna happen. I get that. But So here's the deal. If you, let's say you don't believe something's possible, your heart is not in it. I say do it 12 times and eventually your heart will catch up. Like, you don't have to necessarily believe it initially, but you just got to do it. I was, you know, in 2010, I decided I was going to become a vegetarian. And I wasn't necessarily, I was in Tuscany at the time, and, you know, it's chicken and pork and all kinds of great meats. And I decided I was going to become a vegetarian. And I wasn't feeling it. And I was there with a bunch of writers, and they were like, you're not going to be able to do this. And I just did it. The first time was horrible. The second time was horrible. The fifth time was less horrible. The eighth time was durable. And by the 12th time, I was good. And for the next 2 years, I was a vegetarian.
Hmm.
Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rod, felt in the days when hope unborn had died, yet with a steady beat, have not our weary feet come to the place for which our fathers sighed. We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered, out from the gloomy past, till now we stand at last where the white gleam of our bright star is cast. When James Weldon Johnson wrote the Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, that's what he was writing about. He was writing about that, those weary blues, as Langston Hughes called them, and how we are still here and there is hope, and we got to remain hopeful for ourselves, for our kids, for our kids' kids. But that doesn't mean we don't have to fight. We still got to fight, and that's why I write.
And you write for children and young adults primarily, and I assume that helps with the optimism.
Oh, yes, exactly. I got a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, our goal as parents is to protect them, is to fill their lives with joy, even when they're stressing us out, even when they're challenging everything we say and they want to argue everything. Our goal is to make their lives as happy as possible, even happier than ours were. And I think that's what, as an extension, that's what I'm doing with my writing for kids, that I am ultimately trying to help kids imagine a better world. In order to do that, I got to fill them with joy. I got to give them what's real, and I got to leave them in a place of inspired hope and empowered joy, because that's how I felt when I got to the other side of that bridge and we started singing.
Well, the name of the book is Light for the World to See, 1,000 Words on Race and Hope. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Kwame Alexander, what a great honor and pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you for letting me have this conversation with you. I feel very inspired.
Again, the name of the new book is Light for the World to See, 1,000 Words on Race and Hope, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.